Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. How's everyone doing this Labor Day weekend?
Superb.
Yeah, pretty good. How about you, Jen?
Doing pretty good, except for this heat wave slash humidity thing that's going on in California.
Yeah, there's like fires and stuff.
That's not good.
It's not great.
It's just earth revolting at once.
So, going to our first topic, which is kind of related, I guess, since the weather in California was caused by the hurricane. MLB's responses to the damage in Houston caused by Hurricane Harvey. A lot of teams and players have made charitable contributions and encouraged others to do so as well. For example, MLB and the MLBPA donated $1 million to hurricane relief aid. Several teams have donated proceeds from their 50-50 raffles to hurricane relief. The Astros have unsurprisingly been particularly involved in relief efforts. Jim Crane and his ownership group made a $4 million donation to hurricane victim aid. The team donated 10,000 Carlos Correa jerseys and Strozone t-shirts that would have been given away at the relocated games to one of the big shelters. They provided tickets to fans who were sheltering at the George R. Brown Convention Center. How do we think baseball as a whole handled the way it responded to Harvey?
I think they've done a pretty good job of getting a lot of different people involved. So, like, from the MLB and MLBPA to owners to the players. So I think that at least has been really nice to see.
Yeah, I think this is something that is very personal for a lot of baseball players because, you know, a lot of baseball players come from Texas. It's, you know, a place that, you know, baseball is very big there, and it produces a lot of players who make it to major leagues eventually. And some of the biggest names in baseball are Texas natives. So I think, you know, there was that sort of personal connection that a lot of players had, and that's kind of why this became something that was a particularly big cause with MLB players. Yeah, I think it was nice to see, you know, so many different groups related to MLB get involved and, you know, make donations. It wasn't, you know, obviously it wasn't just something that MLB was doing. It was something we were seeing across, you know, most of the major sports leagues. But yeah, I'd say overall it was good to see MLB going and, you know, actually putting money and resources towards, you know, significant social issues.
Yeah, I think it's nice, particularly that they've been doing like 50-50 raffles, and I know that at least the Red Sox and Yankees are auctioning off game-used equipment, because I think it makes it easier for fans who maybe didn't know how they could help out or wouldn't ordinarily be inclined to help out feel like that they can do something, and it's immediate, and it's in the ballpark, and so it's really easy for them to help out in this regard.
Yeah, definitely. And not only the major league teams are doing it, but the minor league teams as well. I went to a Modesto Nuts game Saturday night, and they were auctioning off batting practice jerseys, batting practice shirts, lineup cards. They were selling things, and all proceeds went to Hurricane Harvey relief. So it's nice to see that, you know, throughout the levels, throughout the sports, there's a lot of people pitching in to help Houston out.
Yeah, it's just overall nice to see teams and, you know, baseball league as a whole do more than just sort of pay lip service to, you know, the whole thoughts and prayers thing. It's nice to see them actually sort of, you know, contributing directly in terms of money and encouraging others to do the same thing that, you know, is actually going to make a real difference in the lives of people who've been affected by this. You know, I guess maybe if you want to nitpick some, there's maybe a little too much in the way of reliance on organizations like the Red Cross, who, you know, maybe aren't the best, like, despite having, you know, one of the bigger names. But, you know, it's obviously better than doing nothing, and it's obviously still going to help a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think I would like to see a little bit more attention paid to more local services, particularly because those are the ones who are going to be there 2, 3, 4 years from now when Houston's still recovering from the hurricane. But overall, I mean, I can't, like, really fault them for donating.
Yeah, and I can only hope that, you know, MLB and MILB and all other sports leagues will do the same if Hurricane Irma hits Florida.
Yeah, you'd like to see that, you know, especially because there's, you know, not one but two major league teams that are likely to be affected by that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it would be nice to see a similar effort and not just, you know, people getting all worked up over this and then not having the energy or the drive or whatever to do it again. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if there's something to be said for maybe, I mean, there's something to be said overall for talking about, you know, the effects of global warming and how it's real and how we need to, you know, be taking efforts to reverse that. And, you know, I don't know if that's Major League Baseball's job to be doing that, but yeah, it's the whole thing about how we're good at, like, responding to disasters and providing, you know, short-term relief, but not so good at taking care of things that are more long-term and, you know, taking preventative measures, I guess, to see that stuff like this doesn't happen going forward. And again, this may be something, or it definitely is something that's bigger than baseball.
How many players, like, really believe in climate change? So...
Yeah, I'm a little scared to think about what those numbers would actually be like if, you know, players were interviewed on that subject.
Yeah. Speaking of Florida, though, as a result of Hurricane Harvey, the Astros-Rangers series that was supposed to be played in Houston was instead played at Tropicana Field in Tampa. The Astros proposed playing the series in Arlington and moving a later series between the two teams to Houston instead, but the Rangers balked at this as it would cause issues with tickets already sold to those games, plus it would mean that Texas would have to play 4 consecutive series on the road in late September. Instead, the game was played at the Rays ballpark, with all proceeds from tickets and concession sales going to hurricane relief. So what do we think of the Rangers' decision, and conversely, what do we think of the way the Rays stepped up to help?
I think it was great that the Rays stepped up to help. I don't know how much I can really fault the Rangers, because their concerns were legitimate, particularly with playing 4 consecutive series on the road in towards the end of the month. It seems like that would kind of be unfair to the Rangers and put them at a disadvantage compared to the rest of the league. So I don't know. I can't really go at them too much for that.
Yeah, my initial reaction was that the Rangers were being kind of petty, and it would have been a nice gesture to have played the series in Arlington, because I get the 4 consecutive road series argument, but that alone doesn't really do it for me, because this whole thing was kind of bigger than any one team. But that said, I do get the logistical concerns involved with the tickets that were already sold for that September series, because that wouldn't have really been fair to the fans who already purchased tickets. Something I did kind of wonder about was if it may have worked for the Astros and Rangers to have played the relocated series in Arlington and then not do the swap, but rather just have the Astros serve as the home team in this series. You know, maybe a neutral site was a better compromise there, since, you know, obviously Arlington wouldn't really have been a neutral site. So maybe there was something to be said for, you know, going to somewhere else to play this series. And obviously it was great of the Rays to step up and, you know, provide that for them. But I don't know, maybe having the series in Arlington would have drawn a bigger crowd than the series at the Trop did, because I don't know, it was maybe like 5,000 something people on average showing up to these games. It wasn't a lot. And I don't know, it's possible they could have raised a lot more in hurricane relief money that way. So, yeah, this is kind of getting long-winded, but I guess what I'm getting at is that Houston obviously has bigger things to be concerned about right now, but I think the Rangers could have been a bit more cooperative than they were, and they had the opportunity to help out, and instead they kind of just created this additional problem that probably didn't need to exist. And, yeah, I think that covers my thoughts on that.
Yeah. I am inclined to agree with that. I think that it ended up, like, I get the business concerns that the Rangers have, and it's completely legitimate concerns, but from the PR-facing standpoint, it just doesn't seem like a good look for them, especially with, you know, the hurricane being bigger than sports in itself right now. That being said, you know, finding a neutral ballpark like the Trop did work out, you know, and the fact that the Rays were willing to donate all proceeds from ticket sales and concessions is a great gesture. Even though it might just seem like it's a drop in the bucket, it is still something. And I think that, you know, with Florida's history of having, you know, a lot of hurricanes passing through, I think they being the Rays, have that experience of knowing what it's like to have to, you know, build up from a hurricane. So there is that level of sympathy that I don't think is really mentioned that much, but it's something that, you know, is kind of understood if you're coming from, like, a Florida team and understanding that recovering from hurricanes can take a long while.
Yeah, that's a really good point. That's something I really hadn't seen much in the way of being discussed in terms of the Rays stepping in like that, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's kind of why I'm a little bit disappointed at the turnout for the three games, because I think that, like, ordinarily for a series, it would have been kind of, like, whatever, in line with the rest of the Rays turnout, but I was really hoping that people would step up, and especially after it was announced that all proceeds would go to the relief effort, I was really hoping that the attendance would be a lot higher for each of the three games.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It would have been nice just to see, well, the Rays in general having a bigger turnout. It's always kind of sad to see when ballparks are empty.
Yeah, in this case, you know, I think it's a combination of the fact that the Rays have a hard time getting people to the ballpark as it is, and this was also on incredibly short notice, so I guess I don't fault, you know, the people of Tampa too much for this, but yeah, I guess that's why I think there was an argument for playing the game in Arlington, because, yeah, I do think that would have drawn a bigger crowd, but it's, you know, it's already happened, so I guess at this point it's not worth dwelling on too much beyond what we already have.
Yeah, definitely. So, our next topic, also involving Houston, but the other side of things. Justin Verlander was traded to Houston at the waiver wire deadline. He was traded in exchange for Franklin Perez, a double-A pitcher, A-ball catcher Jake Rogers, and A-ball outfielder Daz Cameron, who's Mike Cameron's son. Do you think Detroit is finally beginning a full rebuild?
Yeah, based on the moves that they've made, you know, both prior to the trade deadline and the waiver wire deadline, it really seems like they went into full sell mode. I mean, in addition to the Verlander trade, they, you know, traded Justin Upton, and earlier in the season they traded JD Martinez and Justin Wilson, and, you know, got a lot of prospects in return for, you know, with all those combined. So, yeah, I think it would be pretty hard to argue that they aren't in full rebuild mode at this point.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think it's really nice to finally see that from them, because I think a lot of fans were frustrated with the Tigers' indecision for a lot of the past several seasons. So it's always good to see a team kind of commit to a full rebuild.
Yeah, and I feel like they had a lot of moving parts and they had a lot of chances to, you know, to rebuild, but the fact that it took them this long to rebuild is kind of telling that they were kind of dragging their feet on it a little bit and kind of, I guess, trying to make it work for as long as they could until they realized they couldn't. But it's also better late than never that they're starting to rebuild, and certainly getting some guys who are a little bit older, like double A guys, you know, could show that, you know, they're not necessarily too far behind on rebuilding.
Did you guys think that there was a chance that Verlander would stay with the Tigers for the rest of his career?
I thought there was a chance. I mean, that whole thing was kind of nuts at the last minute, where people were reporting that the trade was going to happen and they were like, oh no, it fell through, and it wasn't clear on, you know, why that was happening and whose end it was on. And then it was like, oh, actually the trade did go through. So yeah, the fact that it was as last minute as it was, it really did seem like there was a very real chance that Verlander wasn't going anywhere now and thus could end up being a Tiger for life if, you know, that was the way things ended up going with him in free agency. But yeah, it's bizarre. It's, you know, you get so used to one guy being with one team for so long and then all of a sudden he's somewhere else.
Yeah, with, you know, how it played out and, you know, the reports of like, oh no, it didn't go through, Verlander staying a Tiger. Nope, it did go through, Verlander's going to Houston. You know, that made me think, okay, maybe he wants to stay with the Tigers forever. Nope, he's going to Houston. And I think at some point he'll, you know, players realize that, you know, maybe there's nothing for them the rest of their career with one team. You know, they want to win a ring, so they're going to go to the best possible team that they're, you know, they have a chance with. That being said, you know, the idea of uprooting your entire life from a team that you've played, like, a long, long amount of time for, you know, it's hard to make that decision so quickly, and thinking like, okay, I'm just going to leave it all behind and get to the next city. But, you know, at the same time, there's a lot of players who have to face the same thing and don't have the privilege of having that no trade clause. So there's a lot of different facets to it, and I would not have blamed Verlander at all if he just wanted to spend his career in Detroit, you know, having that comfort and familiarity. But at the same time, you know, players want to win.
Well, as for Houston, are they now undeniably the team to beat in the American League?
Yes. My only concern is whether or not they're going to be able to keep it up and whether or not they're going to start regressing at the worst possible time. And while I don't really believe in jinxes, this could, you know, just fall into the whole Sports Illustrated cover jinx.
As a Dodger fan whose team has just dropped 8 out of 9 games not too long after being on the Sports Illustrated cover with the title Best Team Ever, I have to say I'm kind of believing that more than I have in the past. Like, I'm not that superstitious of a person, but it's it's easy to like fall into the thing where, oh, this team's getting hyped and then they are, you know, not playing up to that same level. Now that said, I think that Houston probably still is the team to beat in the American League. They have the best record in the American League. They have a really, really good team on paper. Their rotation has the potential to be really great in spite of, you know, some recent hiccups. I guess the caveat here is that Cleveland has been playing really well recently. They're on a 12-game winning streak. So they could give them a run for the title of team to beat, but I think right now I would still take Houston.
Yeah, it's definitely between those two teams and then just like 10 middle-of-the-road teams duking it out to see which one of those is going to lose to them in the playoffs. But very happy to the Indians and the Astros go at it in the CS.
Ah, good old wild card.
That piano is so lovely.
For those who are listening who are wonder why there's a piano, I'm visiting my old grad school, University of Southern California, and in the campus center there's a piano that anyone can play. So we've been treated to the stylistic piano playing from a random student at USC, so thumbs up to you.
I think it's good. I think he's doing well to match the tone of the podcast so far. There's like kind of a quiet urgency to it.
Yeah, I think we should actually hire them full time if they're available.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll look in the budget for that.
Yeah, send them Paul's contact information. I can sort it out.
So, Twitter questions. This one is from Nick Stellini, who is at Stellini Tweets. Which MLB player would be best at Velodrome?
Okay, so how many of us had to Google Velodrome?
Yep.
All of us? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically it's like cycling on like a tilted track is my understanding of it.
I knew what it was, but then I wasn't sure if there was like something else called Velodrome that I like just had totally missed. But okay, yeah, it's cycling. We're good.
Yeah. And on that note, I guess the body type of a cyclist tends to be like someone with strong legs and I think not too tall. So maybe like, I feel like pitchers tend to have really strong legs. So maybe like a shorter pitcher like Marcus Stroman or maybe someone who's really fast, like, you know, Billy Hamilton. I think either of them would be good at Velodrome.
My answer is Adrian Beltre, because he is tied for hitting the most cycles in one career. And so he's good at cycling.
That's good. That's thinking outside the box, Mary.
I'm coming to Texas to find you.
I know, I was like, this is going to be my last episode on Hardball Times Audio. It was really nice while it lasted.
I would have to probably go with a catcher just because of the whole strong legs thing. A lot of catchers are shorter than average. In the average ball player, usually they're about 5'8 through 5'10, 5'11. So I'm thinking like maybe Buster Posey or Yadier Molina, maybe. They'd have that stamina in their lower body.
I can see that.
Yeah. I tried to Google to see if like any MLB players were avid cyclists, but nothing came up, so that was not helpful.
Well, there's no current major leaguer, but Barry Bonds is an avid cyclist.
That's a good point. I guess it doesn't have to be a current player.
So. And then I was like, oh, Madison Bumgarner, he likes
one kind of bike. But I think he needs to stay off of bikes during baseball season, at least. Yes. I think that's a lesson he's learned.
So this one is from Emily at Sports Broad. Who is the next team to get a cat? So the Marlins have had one, and I believe the Cardinals have had one. So who's next?
I'm going to say the A's, just because that seems like the sort of thing that would happen to the A's. I feel like anything can happen at Oco, like any sort of animal could come running through at any point, so why not a cat? And they seem like the sort of team that would be into, you know, keeping it around and turning it into a little mascot.
I think the A's are... Yeah. I think maybe the Phillies, because they probably need some happiness. And so a cat running across the field would be, I think, quite delightful for them. But also, like, Philly fans maybe would not react that well to it. Not a stereotype.
Never.
I can't argue with the A's or the Phillies, but I would also have to throw in maybe the White Sox. Just because...
Are you guaranteeing this?
It's a guaranteed rate for cats to show up at ballparks.
Jen.
Mary started. I will point the finger at Mary on that one.
Well, now I have a bar set really high for me to say something super cringeworthy, so thanks, guys.
Anytime. We're here to build up your brand.
I say this with love, of course.
So, yeah, White Sox, just because I feel like they're trying to draw a little more attention than the Cubs, considering, you know, the whole finally winning a World Series thing, and obviously the trading for top prospects thing isn't enough, so they need a cat.
Right, but then, like, if it's a black cat, then you have a black cat and a billy goat, and, like, that's just going to be a whole thing.
But maybe they can fight the stigma around black cats. Maybe that can be a thing.
That's true.
I just have to say, as an owner of a black dog, black furred animals are fantastic.
They are. Except
it's strongly agreed.
My first dog was black. He was very nice.
Yeah, they are, except it's hard to see them in the dark, and, like, I can't even tell you how many times I've accidentally stepped on him, and I feel so bad.
Yeah. You
this
just,
is
like,
yeah.
Their glowing eyes, that's, like, the only way you can tell.
Pretty much. This is definitely on topic, by the way.
Yeah.
Very baseball related.
Well, you know, Air Bud played baseball, so.
There you go.
That's why we're getting paid.
So, our next question is from AJ at AJ on the Guitar. How much of playoff success do you personally see as luck? For instance, the 06 Cardinals being just two games above 500, a few Giants teams who were considered mediocre winning, and does this make baseball the best sport?
Skills luck?
Yeah, like, I guess what? On average, just the, like, ratio of the two. It's a little tricky to say. I mean, you know, there's the famous quote from Billy Bean about the playoffs being a crapshoot. And I actually looked this up because I was curious because of this question. Apparently, since the beginning of the wild card era, only four of the 26 teams with the top record went on to win the World Series. So that's just 7% of the teams with the best record. Granted, that's not a huge sample size, and this also doesn't include last year when the Cubs, I'm pretty sure this didn't include last year when the Cubs had the best record and went on to win, but yeah, I don't know, obviously you have to have a good solid team to do well in the playoffs, but you also do need to get most of the breaks going your way, which may or may not happen in a short series, and what might stabilize over the course of a full season doesn't always get the chance to in the postseason. So yeah, I guess while there's definitely going to be luck involved with every World Series champion, maybe it's a little less so with more talented teams. But I don't know, I think even in the case of, like, you know, the best teams, it's probably something like an 80-20 skill and luck split.
Yeah.
If I had to put numbers to it.
Yeah, because, like, the Cubs were obviously, you know, the best team in baseball, but they needed the luck of the rain delay to really bring it home.
Yeah, definitely. And as someone who watched way too many Giants games over the last 10 years, I still don't know how they won three World Series rings or championships, because those were some terrible teams. On paper, at least. I mean, like, Aubrey Huff, Pat Burrell, what the hell? Yeah, I mean, they just find these random throwaway guys like Cody Ross and turn them into local superstars forever, and they're never going to have to pay for a beer again in San Francisco. And I think there was a lot of luck that played into the Giants championships. But I think, you know, there's obviously a mix of luck and just overall talent that, you know, you get this narrative for every postseason, and I think that's what makes baseball, you know, to answer the last question, that's what makes baseball the best sport.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think it definitely benefits from having so few teams make the playoffs. Like if it was, over half the league as it is with the NBA and NHL, you would probably see more of the best teams win out.
Yeah, it is a lot less predictable in baseball, and I think that makes it a lot more fun and, probably should inspire a lot more hope in, fans of teams who maybe we just squeaked into the playoffs. I'm reminded of another quote, which I didn't realize was originally said by Lefty Gomez before I looked it up, but, I'd rather be lucky than good.
Mm-hmm.
You can work as hard as you want to be as good as you want, but in the end, you're going to need certain things to fall your way that you don't necessarily have control over. So there you go.
So our final question also comes from AJ, which is baseball reference war or Fangraphs war?
Both.
I think both have their uses. Baseball reference war for position players is a little bit more all-encompassing, but Fangraphs war for pitchers also plays defense into the formula. So I think it just depends on what you're trying to analyze. Both have its purposes, along with all the other variations of war that are out there, like Baseball Prospectus's WARP. They all have their uses, they all have their strengths, and they all have their weaknesses. So when I look at WAR and write something up comparing everything, I look at, all the WARs and WARPs available to make an analysis.
Yeah, I definitely prefer BREF WAR for pitching because I actually don't love the fact that Fangraphs WAR is calculated using FIP instead of ERA because that doesn't take into account how a pitcher has actually performed, but rather how they should have performed. And I don't think that's really either fair or accurate to, judge the sort of season that they had and how valuable they were to their team. Now, I don't have as strong an opinion when it comes to position player WAR because I actually think those two usually come out a bit more similar. I'd be curious to see, what the difference tends to be between, the two sets of WAR for pitchers and for position players. But just in my experience, I found that there's sometimes big discrepancies between pitcher B WAR and F WAR, but not usually quite as much with position player.
Yeah, I'm just trying to look it up right now to see how closely the position player WARs match up. And also, while I'm doing this, can I just say that I'm slightly mad that the pronunciation is WAR because, it's above, so it should be WAR because you don't say above. But, that's neither here nor there, really.
I'm thinking about, I think I say WAR even though it's, I don't know. Now, this is weird. You've got me thinking about this, and I'm confused now.
So, basically a typical conversation with Mary.
Yeah.
You made me think, and you made me confused, Mary. Thanks.
Anytime.
But yeah, I don't know. I feel like it should be pronounced like the word war. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's my take on this subject.
So sorry to always derail you guys.
Thanks a lot, Mary.
You're welcome. So,
well,
Fangraphs WAR hates Nolan Arenado. He's at 17th in their ranking, and he's number 10 overall on Baseball Reference, which is interesting, but I don't know what that means.
I think maybe Fangraphs overcorrects for Coors. That's something that I feel like is the thing that I've read about.
Mm-hmm. You guys want to move on to last week's articles?
Yeah, sure.
Let's go ahead and do that.
All right. So in this week's Hartball Times articles, we have on Monday, A Visual Case for the DH by Eli Ben Porritt. So he says it's plain and simple, pitchers cannot hit major league pitching. He then takes us through several visual representations of this assessment, pointing out that pitchers have far lower exit velocities and launch angles, which results more often than not in weak ground balls when they can manage to make contact at all. So this inability to hit leads to the eight hitter walking higher percentages of his at-bats than any other spot in the lineup. Of course, every rule has its exceptions, this time being Noah Syndergaard, Bumgarner, and Jake Arrieta. Then on Tuesday, he presents the converse argument of Monday's article, explaining that because hitters don't hit doesn't mean that they can't do so. Much of the pitcher's supposed inability to hit is due to the existence of the DH, as there is little value in grooming a pitcher's ability to hit. He walks us through several graphs pointing out that prior to the institution of the DH, pitchers were far better hitters than they are post-DH, but obviously that's not the whole story. Both arguments provide interesting information, and regardless of where you fall in this debate, I think you'll find something interesting or enlightening in each of them.
All right. On Wednesday, we have Grand Tour 5, Baseball Lives by Shane Tortolode. Shane details his fifth annual baseball road trip, with this one taking him to 5 major league and 2 minor league ballparks, as well as a stop at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. Experiencing baseball in so many different and unique settings helps to rejuvenate Shane's love of the game. To see which stadiums he visited and to find out about his trip to each one, head to the Hardball Times and give this a read. On Thursday, we have King of the Mountain, How Zach Greinke Took Control in Coors Field by Jan Moffitt. Here, Jan looks into the success that Zach Greinke has enjoyed at the notoriously pitcher-unfriendly Coors Field. It's looking increasingly like the NL wildcard game will be between the Diamondbacks and the Rockies, and Greinke, the Arizona ace, will surely get that start. If it ends up being in Colorado, this piece will be extra relevant. But even if not, it's still an interesting read about a fascinating pitcher at a confounding ballpark. And finally, on Friday, we have The Physics of, quote-unquote, Late Break by David Kagan. In this piece, David examines the physics behind breaking pitches and attempts to correct a particular semantical issue with regards to them. While we're used to hearing the phrase late break in reference to certain pitches, David argues that it's redundant because all breaking pitches break late into the ball's trajectory. He lays out what I thought was a pretty convincing argument, but you'll have to read for yourself to see whether or not you agree.
And next week, on Monday, which actually is today, there's no article because it's Labor Day. Happy Labor Day to everyone. On Tuesday, Paul Swiden is announcing changes to the site and the annual book. On Wednesday, we have Shane Tortolotti with a first piece in the September series on the 1967 AL pennant race. On Thursday, we have Frank Jackson with a subject matter to remain a surprise. And on Friday, we have John Pashka on A Player's Weekend Past, a whimsical exercise in nickname creation. Before we finish up, we have a bit of housekeeping news. By the time you'll hear this, Hardball Times will have a new web address. From now on, you'll need to go to fangraphs.com/THT to access the articles. Again, that's fangraphs.com/THT. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @jenmacramos. You can find Sarah at @sarahwexler32. You can find Mary at @marymcraig. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.